So I'm going to introduce our workshop leader. I actually have been in contact with Katie for a few months now through email and texts and phone calls, but I got to meet her last night and got to hear her story. And she had a great story. I totally, I was very connected to it. I'm very awkward in my sense of humor, same way. I pretended to be sober for a few months for a man and, you know, same exact thing. So I laughed and I got emotional thinking about it, and she's just got a wonderful story. So I can't wait to hear this workshop on responsibility is sexy. So further ado, Katie. Hi, I'm Katie. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, so this whole responsibility is sexy thing was kind of a half joke that I think was really good that it worked out that way. Because, you know, I don't know how many people really want to come to a workshop at 1:30 on a Saturday afternoon that is called I Am Responsible. So I was like, that doesn't sound very sexy. Like, we need to call it something sexy, like responsibility is sexy. And Bill was like, okay. All right, so there it was billed. And I honestly, I think at the end of the day that actually becomes quite true. I got to tell you, right, like workshops are always a little bit awkward for me because I can talk. But when I need to talk about like facts and things and stuff and like anchor, it's difficult for me. So we're all going to get through like this little bit of awkwardness today because I have to like have notes and reference them. And like I'm not one of those really professional TED Talk people that has all of their little talking points memorized before like I do a workshop. So we're all going to get through this together today. But I think that we're still going to have fun despite any bit of awkwardness that might happen. So anyway, I appreciate you guys all being here for a responsibility workshop in the afternoon. And I have to tell you, too, that, like I said, responsibility, I do believe, became very sexy to me. And I can tell you that a clear indicator, we were joking earlier, of the fact that I had had a spiritual awakening of some kind was when, like, I thought a spiritual program looked incredibly sexy on a man. Like, when that happened, I clearly had had some kind of a personality change, because a spiritual program of action and responsibility and those kind of things on a man before had like been the opposite of attractive. You know, attractive to me was like, yeah, something else. So I do believe at the end of the day that it's actually quite sexy. So I also have to talk about that I feel like there's a lot of irony in the fact that I am doing a responsibility workshop. And I say that because I have spent most of my life avoiding responsibility. And when I look back on my story, I really, truly, like most of my life was spent avoiding being responsible for anything. And then, you know, what's interesting is this last couple of years, and if you were here last night and heard about my story, like I've just had a lot of really interesting career changes and have been in, you know, more of a leadership and ownership position in the last couple of years. And it's funny, like do you know that they have a word for it now? It's not even just being an alcoholic, but I think it's like the something syndrome where you feel like you're not qualified, like for your job. It's imposter syndrome. Thank you. Yes. Like there's actually a term for it now called imposter syndrome, like that constant feeling of like, I feel like I'm just pretending to do my job, and these people are not onto the fact that I have no idea what I'm doing. And I really think that a lot of that is because, at least for me, like, well, aside from, you know, the inherent, like, low self-esteem and blah, blah, blah stuff that comes along with being an alcoholic, right, is that, like, I've gotten to a place where I'm by some kind of amazing miracle, you know, and really only through spiritual work did I get to a place where I'm able to do what I do today. Because I did not get there through the really naturally, you know, let's go to a four-year institution, study exactly what I want to study, and set a five-year plan, and then hit A, B, C. Like, that's not how I operate. That's never been how I rolled anyway. And the only way that I got, you know, to do some of the cool stuff that I do today is because I trusted God and showed up and was responsible for doing the work in front of me. You know, that is the only way that I got to do the stuff that I get to do today. You know, and this last year, I was invited to moderate a leadership panel in my industry, like with these three amazing women who like are just wow, these great women in my industry. I got to moderate a panel because somewhere in there, I'm viewed as a leader who can moderate this panel. And then I was actually asked to be on a leadership panel for people in my field. And then I was like, that is really weird. And while technically I fulfill that role and I'm in a leadership position for what I do in my industry, it does not feel like, really? How am I? You know, and I referenced it last night. I really truly believe everything that I've learned about leadership I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous through being of service. So that's why I think this kind of stuff is like really close to my heart and really important to me, because it's where I learned how to do grown-up things, really. So the first thing I want to do is look a little bit at the AA history regarding responsibility and the word responsible. So I found out that variations of the word responsible show up 11 times in the first 164 pages of the Big Book, mostly referencing our drinking and our initial recovery. And then in the 12 and 12, the word makes twice as many appearances at 22, the large majority of which are found in the chapter on the 12th step and in the chapters pertaining to the 12 traditions. So that's where we learn most of our responsibility stuff. So it seems like this word seems to have a great deal of significance in our fellowship. After the first international convention in Cleveland in 1950, this was the year we adopted the traditions and we began a 5-year trial for the General Service Conference. So this was the first time we were trying to do this General Service Conference thing, and we had just adopted the tradition. So this was the first year that responsibility kind of started to become a big word in Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And then, 5 years later, at the second International Convention in St. Louis in 1955, responsibility for Alcoholics Anonymous was officially turned over to us, to the groups. Responsibility for Alcoholics Anonymous. The old timers basically said, here you go. There you are. And our three legacies of recovery were also put out at that conference. So recovery, unity, and service. That was also adopted at that conference. So then, in 1965, at the fourth International Convention in Toronto, our beloved Responsibility Declaration was born. And so that's where we heard that for the first time. And if you're not familiar, the Responsibility Declaration is, I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that, I am responsible. Then, expounding on this declaration, Dr. Jack Norris wrote in the AA souvenir book at that convention. They always have some kind of a souvenir book at the convention. He wrote a little bit about the theme and said, we must remember that AA will continue strongly only so long as each of us freely and happily gives it away to another person. Only as each of us takes our fair share of responsibility for sponsorship for those who still suffer, for the growth and integrity of our group, for intergroup activities, and for AA as a whole. It is in taking responsibility that real freedom and the enduring satisfactions of life are found. AA has given us the power to choose, to drink or not to drink, and in doing so has given us the freedom to be responsible for ourselves. As we become responsible for ourselves, we are free to be responsible for our share in AA. And unless we happily accept this responsibility, we lose AA. Strange, isn't it? That's what it says. So, all right, wow. So we inherited AA. Now what? So I think let's have a look at the idea of responsibility through the lens of our three legacies. So recovery, unity, and service. And I got to say, like, AA is like no other organization in the world in that we are truly directed through the collective voice of all of us. No one tells us what to do. No one really could ever tell us what to do anyway, let's face it. But no one tells us what to do. Suggestions, perhaps strong suggestions, are made out of experience, but no one tells us what to do. So that's great. But so what does it mean to be responsible? Like, what does that word actually mean? And just like earlier when Joy did, I went to Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Always a good place to start. So definition 1A, liable to be called on to answer. 1B, liable to be called on to account as the primary cause, motive, or agent, as in a committee responsible for the job. 2A, able to answer for one's own conduct and obligations. Trustworthy, not usually a word associated with an alcoholic. 2B, able to choose for oneself between right and wrong. So some sort of discernment comes along with responsibility. Oof. So anyway, as a newcomer, right, I had no idea what it meant to be responsible for myself. I was still stealing money from my dad's wallet for the first 2 months when I went to meetings so that I had a dollar to put in the coffee, in the hat, and that I had a dollar for coffee. So responsibility was not something. And plus, I was, you know, almost 18 years old when I came here. So alcoholic and a teenager. Like, clearly responsibility was not a word anywhere in my vocabulary. So I was barely able to accept responsibility for anything outside of myself, you know, but AA began to teach me without me really realizing it. It was totally secret code language as far as I'm concerned, to begin to have some kind of basic responsibility for myself. And so it is within the first legacy that I think me and most of us got our first big dose of accepting responsibility, recovery. So in step one, my entire alcoholic being, like, rebels against the idea of responsibility. So in taking the first step, a great deal of relief came from the idea that I was not responsible for this disease called alcoholism. Like, oh, that's what's wrong with me. I just thought I was a crazy person that bad things happened to, but I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics are sick. Whew. That explains a lot, right? So alcoholism was my problem. However, my relief at this was very soon replaced with annoyance because members suddenly felt the need to inform me that while I was not responsible for my alcoholism, I was responsible for my recovery, which meant work, right? So here's spoiler alert, responsibility seems to always mean work of some kind, right? This is what I'm learning. So then steps two and three come along, right? And my next disappointment came with that. Because I really did fight the idea of a higher power like tooth and nail, because I was extremely agnostic and I love to argue, as we talked about last night. And fortunately for me, no one in AA would argue with me. So when I was finally ready and willing to lay aside all of my prejudices and accept the idea that perhaps some kind of power greater than me might like swoop me up in his celestial arms and take care of me for the rest of my life, I was told that once again, I was going to have to be responsible for something. The 12 and 12 goes on about God will restore me to sanity, restore us to sanity if we rightly relate ourselves to him, meaning work. So the third step literature kept going on and on about the use of my will. And if I committed to the third step, it meant that I was now going to be responsible for making some kind of effort to act how I thought this higher power thing would have me act, and that I was going to have to do things like pray and be nice and do the next right thing and be honest and try to be helpful to other people. This was hardly turning out to be anything like lulling in the cradling arms of some mighty savior for the rest of my life. So, disappointing, but we moved on, right? So, then as you can probably guess, a load of responsibility continued to mount in the fourth and fifth steps, because all of the people and institutions and principles that had so clearly been my downfall were all now stripped of their responsibility for my sorry state, and the responsibility for my life and my problems was placed squarely on me. Step four in the 12 and 12 talks about these two extreme categories of those of us who do not want to take a four-step inventory. And the first they describe as the depressive type. And this is the inconsolable person who is just, it's everything is all their fault, and they're just a burr on the butt of the earth, and they should just be eliminated, and everybody would just be happy anyway if they all just went away, and it's not going to work, and so why should I bother anyway? So there's that person, right? And then there's the one who is inclined toward self-righteousness and grandiosity and needn't do an inventory because they're great now that they're sober and the other stuff is someone else's fault anyway. So to this day, though, I have to tell you that I can easily toggle before either one of these extremes, right? It is not that hard to do. So when confronted with the emergence of one of my character defects, I can just psh, 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 back and forth like a ping pong ball, like enough to make my sponsor's head spin. Like literally be in one place like, oh, I just suck and I shouldn't even bother. And then 5 minutes later, I'd be like, I don't even understand why this is so important and why everybody's making such a big deal out of this. Right? Like back and forth, back and forth. So what I realized about both of those extremes and why those are both really comfortable places for me is both of them avoid responsibility, right? Because if I'm just a burr on the butt of the earth and there's no point in doing anything anyway and it's not going to matter, right, then why bother starting? I don't have to be responsible for making any changes, right? And then, of course, if I'm awesome and everything is really just someone else's fault and I am clearly a victim of circumstance, then I don't have to be responsible for anything there either, right? Which leads me to what I lovingly try to call, like what I've come to call the grown-up middle. This is what I call the grown-up middle. And the grown-up middle is where, yeah, I screwed up and I also need to, like, take some responsibility to make some changes in my life. That is not a comfortable place for me to live in, but I've learned that that is the right place for me to live in. So, and then, right? So, as I've come to call it over the years, admit fault, take responsibility for corrective action, and that's not a naturally comfortable place for me. Bill W. once said, "The essence of all growth is a willingness to change for the better, and then an unremitting willingness to shoulder whatever responsibility this entails." That is a very serious statement, by the way, right? So I'm going to read it again. The essence of all growth is a willingness to change for the better, and then an unremitting willingness to shoulder whatever responsibility this entails. I love that line, but there's a lot of responsibility in that line. So another gem from the 12 and 12 points out, we have not once sought to be one in a family, to be a friend among friends, to be a worker among workers, to be a useful member of society. Always, we tried to struggle to the top of the heap or to hide underneath it. This self-centered behavior blocked a partnership relation with any one of those about us. Of true brotherhood, we had small comprehension. This appears to also be another variation of lack of responsibility, because if I rule the world, then everyone else should be responsible to fulfill my whims and desires, as far as I am concerned, right? Or alternatively, if I am as incapable as a child, then someone else should be responsible to take care of me. So once again, these are two eerily comfortable extremes for me. The grown-up middle here seems to mean that I have to take responsibility to be a good employee, a good friend, and a good family member while not being concerned about being better at it than anyone else. So being a useful member of society, which was not exactly a sexy-sounding promise when I got here, and not something, oh, gosh, someday I aspire to be a useful member of society. That sounds so sexy. So then moving on, right? So step 6 and 7. The responsibility continues to pile on, as the 12 and 12 announces at the beginning of step 6. This is the step that separates the men from the boys. Any person capable of enough willingness and honesty to try repeatedly step 6 on all his faults without any reservations whatever has indeed come a long way spiritually. So, the first time that I really carefully studied steps 6 and 7 was not actually my first time through the steps. I think the first time through the steps, I was like, okay, yeah, willing, we're going to change. Right, let's move on to amends. Yay, go. So it was actually a couple of years into the program. And a few years into the program, I hit, you know, what I like to lovingly refer to as one of my sobriety bottoms. And my sobriety bottom was just a pit of character defect awareness where, you know, I basically was just pushing away a lot of people in my life. And, I mean, I'm going to say it. I always wonder where that line is. Where's the line between, like, cussing and not cussing? Like, what's the, you know, is it only those really 7 words that you can't say? But basically, I was a bitch. That's basically, I think that's okay to say. But that was the big character defect, and what it came down to was really I treated people badly, and especially other women, that I was great at, like, pushing other women away, acting like I was better at other women. And I realized, and I say I realized, really it was pointed out to me by my sponsor as I sort of bottomed out. It was lovingly pointed out to me what was happening, and that it was this defect, you know, and that she had also heard from some of the other ladies, like, some of the things that I would say and do. And it was like it had never occurred to me. It was the first time I realized that I had these defects that I just acted out of, and, like, I didn't even know. Like, I really didn't realize. Like, I didn't know that I was treating people so badly. And the things that I would say that I thought were funny were repeated back to me in context, and I was like, oh, God, like, I said, really? I said that? And it was so ugly. So it was just this mirror of ugly that was put in front of me. And so I bottomed out. And I was in this place of, like, I was so terrified that I was going to act out of it. Like, now I was aware, and I kind of built up this bottom, had all these kind of consequences, and I had to sort of pick myself up and move forward. And I was really afraid that somehow the same things were going to happen again, like when I wasn't looking, you know, like that somehow I was afraid to be, you know, funny even at all in this place. And, you know, my sponsor reminded me then that what I needed to do was take this one day at a time. And that just like my first few months without a drink, I had no idea how I was going to go on for the rest of my life without being a bitch or living in these prideful character defects. I was afraid to even feel good for 1 minute, lest I get too comfortable. And it appears that my disease thinking once again tries to avoid responsibility by making anything too difficult to do perfectly for the rest of my life, right? Because if I can't do it perfectly for the rest of my life, then I shouldn't even bother, right? Like, why bother starting? It's kind of like being the burr on the ass of the earth, really. I mean, you know, same thing. So might as well give up now. So once again, the responsible grown-up middle means taking the corrective actions one day at a time without worrying about how I'm going to do it for the rest of my life. And I'm always amazed that when I humbly begin this process of surrender and action, that God actually seems to make the process a whole lot easier than I thought. And amazingly, I end up feeling free. But in the moment of awareness of some of those character defects, it is less than pleasant. And it is a like, okay, I'm going to be aware one day at a time, 1 hour at a time. I'm not going to live out of this defect. And so that's my responsibility, right? So steps 8 and 9, they don't need any explanation from me regarding how they bring about still more this idea of responsibility. So having to actually go to people, admit wrong, and take corrective action was a terrifying exercise in responsibility. And I really felt like at that point that I was beginning to shoulder some of the responsibility because I was really painting myself into a corner by admitting my faults and committing to make things right. So I was really beginning to take on some responsibility. Now, at the same time, this is also the portion of the program where so many of our promises begin to come true. You know, those promises that we read in every meeting, of course, are, you know, in step 8. And they begin with, we will know a new freedom and a new happiness. And that bit that I read earlier in the 1965 International Convention souvenir book also talked about freedom. It is in taking responsibility that real freedom and the enduring satisfactions of life are found. This is a revolutionary concept for me, in my little alcoholic brain. And I had always imagined freedom as being a life without responsibility. I mean, that was my idea of what I thought freedom really was like, I'm not responsible for anything. I am free. And here I am for the first time in forever experiencing a sense of freedom, and it is because I have taken some responsibility. So moving on to step 10. Essentially more of the same, right? The big book says our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. But this is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. And so this whole positively, like, reeks of continued responsibility and living life in that grown-up middle place, like, consistently, right? Step 11 then takes my side of my relationship with God to a whole other level of responsibility. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. So, not only do I need to continue to pray and to learn how to meditate, I also need to become even more responsible about developing this conscious contact throughout the day in everything that I do. But once again, I am consistently amazed that the more that I actually practice the 11th step, the more God seems to jump in and help out, and the more that I experience a bigger sense of freedom than ever before, all from this whole responsible, diligent practice. Step 12, clearly work, right? Clearly work. So now I have to practice these principles in all of my affairs. Now I have to carry this message to other alcoholics. Fortunately, by this time, I have had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and the work is not really at this point as daunting as it sounds. In fact, I've already begun to practice this step before I even really get to step 12. And by this time, I've already experienced some kind of amazing freedom from the actual byproduct of responsibility. And when I land on step 12, I've had a spiritual awakening, and I've taken the responsibility to make, because I have taken the responsibility to make myself ready to receive the gift of a spiritual awakening. So the responsibility that I'm charged with in step 12 to carry this message to alcoholics also leads me directly into the next two legacies, right? Unity and service. So we talked about recovery. We're going to talk about unity and service. So to once again quote, I love this little thing, the 1965 International Committee's souvenir book, as we become responsible for ourselves, we are free to be responsible for our share in AA. And unless we happily accept this responsibility, we lose AA. So having a share in something means that I have some ownership in AA. I have a share. When I own something, I am charged with being responsible for it, kind of like renting. When I rent a house or an apartment, I can, like, pick up the phone when something is broken and call somebody, and then, like magic, they come and fix it. And then when I own my house and something breaks, I have to figure out how I'm going to fix it. So, or my husband does, one of us. Anyway, so in 1955, the old-timers gave AA to us, the fellowship, right? So the next legacy we're going to talk about is unity. And so just how am I supposed to be responsible for AA's unity? Like, how are you responsible for unity? I certainly can't run around, like, making everyone else be unified, right? Nor can I sit around and whine about how, like, this group or that group, and they're so cliquish, and I don't understand, and da-da-da-da-da. Like, my responsibility, as far as unity is concerned, is to make myself unified with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is my responsibility, right? So our 12 traditions were designed to keep us from destroying AA from the inside out, basically, primary purpose, really. So to keep a fellowship with no rules and great freedom from falling apart requires great responsibility. So here, I look no further than the fabulous traditions checklist, which was very nicely given to me by our corrections rep, because I realized I got here and I forgot it. So thank you. Yay, corrections rep. Our traditions checklist. So, spoiler alert, this traditions checklist says absolutely nothing about what anybody else does. It asks me about what I do, right? My responsibility, totally great. So I'm just going to read like a few of these, right? So let's take, for example, the first tradition. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. The first question is, am I in my group a healing, mending, integrating person, or am I divisive? What about gossip and taking other members' inventories? Asking about my behavior. 2, am I a peacemaker? Or do I, with pious preludes such as, just for the sake of discussion, plunge into argument? Do I put down some AA activities as if I were superior for not participating in this or that aspect of AA? You know, like those service people, because there's so much politics involved in service. I don't want to be involved in all this politics that go on. The assembly. Politics. Am I informed about AA as a whole? So my responsibility is to be informed about AA as a whole. Do I support in every way I can AA as a whole, or just the parts that I understand and approve of? Right? A little rough understanding about one, right? So tradition 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority. A loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience, our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Do I criticize or do I trust and support my group officers, AA committees, and office workers, newcomers, old-timers? 2. Am I absolutely trustworthy, even in secret, with AA 12-step jobs or other responsibilities? Although I have been sober a few years, am I still willing to serve my turn at AA chores? Right? Tradition 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. I love the first question. In my mind, do I prejudge some new AA members as losers? By the way, some of the writing in here is kind of hilarious. I just have to say, if you've never picked this up and read it, it's kind of fun. So, all right. And also, is there some kind of alcoholic whom I privately do not want in my AA group? Do I set myself up as judge of whether a newcomer is sincere or phony? Are they going to make it? I don't know. I'm not sure. Do I let language, religion, or lack of it, race, education, age, or other such things interfere with my carrying the message? Tradition 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Do I insist that there are only a few right ways of doing things in AA? Do my favorite is when you walk into a workshop and somebody talks about the way AA ought to be. Actually, I know what I... Okay, here, things that chap my hide, right? If I go to hear a speaker and they don't tell their story, but they instead talk about the way AA ought to be, chaps my hide. I was like, I came to hear a story. I came to hear experience, strength, and hope, not your opinion about the way that AA ought to be run. If I have opinions about the way AA ought to be run, then my butt needs to be serving in some aspect of AA so that I can talk about the way I think AA needs to be run. If I'm up here being a speaker, I need to tell my dang alcoholic story. I'm just saying. I might, there might be some resentment in there somewhere, and I'll talk to my sponsor about that later. So anyway, moving right along to tradition five. Do I ever cop out? Oh, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Do I ever cop out by saying, I'm not a group, so this or that tradition doesn't apply to me? I can tell you very much that I avoided traditions meetings in general, like the plague, for the first long while that I was in AA. And if I walked into a traditions meeting, it was 100% by accident, because I wanted to talk about me. And if you guys were talking about the traditions, then it was not as easy for me to talk about me. I had to talk about things that I needed to be responsible for. So, oof, nobody wants that. So, am I willing to 12-step the next newcomer without regard to what, who or what is in it for me? An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Should my fellow group members and I go out and raise money to endow several AA beds in our local hospital? Probably not. Are there officers and members of our local club with AAs who are familiar with guidelines on clubs, which is available from GSO? I do think if you have a meeting and you are in a clubhouse, that being responsible for reading guidelines on clubs is actually a really good idea, because there's a lot of confusion often, you know, between members who've been around for a long time and also newcomers who have been around for a long time about where that line is between clubhouses and groups and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that that's important. There's my other sideline. Look, I get to throw out my opinions. It's my workshop. I'm not telling my story here. So anyway, it goes on. So I'm just going to read a few more of these. So honestly, I love this one, right? Under every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. It says, honestly now, do I do all I can to help AA, my group, my central office, my GSO, remain self-supporting? Could I put a little more into the basket on behalf of the new guy who can't afford it yet? How generous was I when I was tanked in a bar room? I just love the honestly now. Come on, girl. All right. And then tradition eight. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Do I try to sound in AA like an expert on alcoholism, on recovery, or medicine, on sociology, on AA itself, on psychology, on spiritual matters, or heaven help me, even on humility? That's what it says, or heaven help me, even on humility. Do I make an effort to understand what AA employees do, what workers and other alcoholism agencies do? Can I distinguish clearly among them? Tradition 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Do I still try to boss things in AA? Do I resist formal aspects of AA because I fear them as authoritative? Am I aware of all those things, all those to whom I am responsible in any AA job? Then, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn to public controversy. Do I ever give the impression that there is really an AA opinion on anabuse, tranquilizers, doctors, psychiatrists, churches, hospitals, jails, alcohol, the federal, state, or government, legalizing marijuana, vitamins, Al-Anon, Alateen? So do I ever give the impression? Can I honestly say that, or can I honestly share my own personal experiences concerning any of these without giving the impression that I am stating AA opinion? So that is something that I am responsible for, making sure that I don't sound like I'm speaking for Alcoholics Anonymous when I decide to espouse my opinion on any one thing. Because whenever anybody asks me what does AA think about this or that, it's, oh, let's go to the literature. Let me go to the literature. If they wrote anything on it, if there's any guidelines on it, we're going to go to the literature. Because that is technically whatever AA has said on it. But outside issues, AA has no opinion. I might have opinions. I might have a lot of opinions. But also, even if I have my own opinions, I need to be really careful about how I share them with anybody and how I qualify them, but also how I share them. Because you know what? I'm a walking copy of the big book everywhere that I go. That's part of my responsibility, too. So, our public relations policy, Tradition 11, is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. So, do I sometimes promote AA so fanatically that I make it seem unattractive? Am I always careful to keep the confidences reposed in me as an AA member? Am I careful about throwing AA names around even within the fellowship? Tradition 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. So why is it a good idea for me to place the common welfare of all AA members before individual welfare? What would happen to me if AA as a whole disappeared? That might be bad for all concerned. Do I ever try to get certain AA groups to conform to my standards and not their own? And have I a personal responsibility in helping an AA group fulfill its primary purpose? What is my part? So you get the idea, and there's a lot more questions in here, but that all of those have to do with me and my personal responsibility as far as the traditions are concerned. So that is a huge part of how I unify myself with Alcoholics Anonymous, is understanding what AA is and isn't, and understanding what the traditions are, and how well me as an individual member in my group conduct myself along the lines of the traditions. That is my responsibility with unity, right? So, after reading the checklist, I also found a very appropriate quote from Bill W.'s talk at the 1955 International Convention in St. Louis. The 12 traditions also point straight at many of our individual defects. By implication, they ask each of us to lay aside pride and resentment. They ask for personal as well as group sacrifice. My defects. That's the reason we have them, so we don't kill ourselves. So, this is a great reminder that the three legacies of recovery, unity, and service are inextricably linked. So now I'm a unified part of this incredible fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of recovery in our 12 steps. So life is good, right? Then as the book says, as new power flows in, and it's a great power, right? But do you remember what Spider-Man was told about power? With great power comes great
responsibility.
Nerds, I love you. Great. So this brings us to our third legacy of service. So service, right? If I really want the hand of AA to always be there when someone reaches out for help, how do I make sure that that happens, right? So first, I need to stay sober myself, using the first legacy of recovery. Secondly, I need to make sure that, you know, somebody is here when they show up by adhering to the traditions and unifying myself with the fellowship, right? So now, I need to make sure that the hand is extended. So, what is service? So, for this, I'm going to go to our beloved AA service manual, in which Bill writes, our 12th step, carrying the message, is the basic service that the AA fellowship gives. This is our principal aim and the main reason for our existence. Therefore, AA is more than a set of principles. It is a society of alcoholics in action. We must carry the message, else we ourselves can wither, and those who haven't been given the truth may die. That's heavy, right? That's a lot. So, he goes on. Hence, an AA service is anything whatever that helps us to reach a fellow sufferer, ranging all the way from the 12th step itself to a 10-cent phone call. That's awesome. And a cup of coffee to the AA's General Service Office for National and International Action. The sum total of all these services is our third legacy of service. So I began to take some responsibility for AA's third legacy of service as I became an alcoholic in action, usually slowly and unwittingly, so to help carry the message. When I made my first pot of coffee, or when I picked up my first cigarette butt outside of a meeting, or when I said, hey, to a newcomer, even though I didn't know what else to say after that. And I began to fulfill a small part of this legacy that I inherited. So, amazingly, the more that I became willing to do these stupid things that you people told me to do, which is exactly how I felt about them, the more I began to feel a part of the unity of this program. You know, that was when, that point when I started being of service and helping set up chairs and doing all of those silly things is when I made the transition from coming to your meetings to coming to my meetings. You guys were coming to my meeting. This was my group and my meeting. That's when that transition began to happen. That was through service. So when I talked to a newcomer and shared my little bit of experience, strength, and hope, I began to realize that I actually had experience, strength, and hope to give, which was a great discovery after a while, and that I began to feel just a little bit more ownership for my recovery. So I got to say I was terrified when I got my first sponsee because I thought that being a sponsor meant that I was responsible for them. Right? And that if she drank, then I had completely and utterly failed. Right? I came to realize, of course, that I was responsible to be of service and to carry the message and to share my experience, strength, and hope. But that I didn't have to know everything, and I was not expected to be in control of anything. It meant that I could just be willing to do the work and the next right thing and ask questions and ask for help as needed and being willing to be spiritually grounded, like that was my responsibility with Sponsee, to pick up the phone and to be there and to share my experience, strength, and hope, but not to make anybody do anything and not to make anybody stay sober, but to carry the message and that in doing that, of course, that I would actually stay sober. So that is cool. So there is a lot of work that goes into making sure that AA is there for the next alcoholic who needs it. So once again, to quote Bill W. from the AA service manual, services include meeting places, hospitals, cooperation, and intergroup hospital cooperation and intergroup offices. They mean pamphlets, books, and good publicity of almost every description. They call for committees, delegates, trustees, and conferences. And not to be forgotten, they need voluntary money contributions from within the fellowship. So there's a job for every person in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I believe that my responsibility to AA is to make sure that I always have one, right? My job might be coffee maker. It might be a meeting chair. It might be ordering literature. It might be being the GSR. It might be being the area secretary. You know, it might be coordinating jail meetings for corrections. It might be writing articles for the Grapevine. It might be helping out with PICPC, or at least even learning what the heck that stands for, right? Or serving at the district, area, or general conference levels, right? There is always a job that will be a good fit for my personality, my availability, my strengths, my skills, and my experience. There is always going to be a job for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you heard my story last night, I talked a little bit about the fact that I've been blessed to be able to, like, serve, you know, do a lot of general service, which is, I think, so cool because it's just a fun learning curve. I really learned a lot being able to do that and really being able to watch spiritual principles in action, you know? I have a hard time with people who do that, like, I don't want to get involved and be a GSR because I don't want to do all this politics. I don't want to be involved in the politics of AA. I mean, what I've discovered is that really that's just some kind of fearful prejudice, because when I became involved, now it doesn't mean that you're not dealing with people who have character defects and opinions, because we're alcoholics. I promise you that we have character defects and opinions. But what is so great is witnessing the magic of how the principles of our program supersede all of that. You know, and watching that consciousness of God come through all of the discussions and deliberations and everything else. And the other thing that I learned is, character defects aside, people will talk passionately in some of those meetings. People will stand up at the microphone at the area assembly, and they will speak passionately about stuff, and it will be controversial, and the next person will come, and they will speak passionately. But you know what? It is because people love Alcoholics Anonymous. It is because people love Alcoholics Anonymous. They care, they show up, and they want to make sure that that Alcoholics Anonymous is there for the next alcoholic. And we may have different ideas about how that needs to happen, but people come up to the mic and they speak really passionately, then we all get to discuss it, and then we have a vote, and then you know what? The best idea usually moves forward. And you know what? Even when not the best idea moves forward, there's another assembly down the road, and we might change it. Because we can do that. We're Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Spiritual principles always pervade. And what's amazing to me, too, is that most of those personalities that are really speaking so passionately have great respect for that spiritual solution that always emerges. And once we've made a decision, we'll adhere to the unity of that decision. You know, even in my own home group, and I'm sure even in your own home groups, I mean, if you go to your group conscience meetings, like, we don't always agree on stuff, and we may be back. It's usually important issues like coffee, how we set up the chairs. I mean, it's usually that kind of really important stuff, and we will have heated debates on how we are going to do that. You know, or the chairperson reading. So that's always the one that's like, no, we need to have this in there. No, we don't. It's too long. You know, we'll go back and forth. But at the end of the day, our whole group, like, we'll figure out what it is, the reading, the coffee procedure, the whatever it is, and we all rally behind it, and we do what we decided we would do as that group conscience, right? That's our responsibility. Really cool stuff to watch. So there's a job, right? There's a job. So I've had all these great jobs that I've been able to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and right now I have the job that I avoided for many, many years. I'm actually our group treasurer. I never wanted to be the treasurer of anything because that reeks. I mean, treasurers really have responsibility, and they have to, like, make numbers match and stuff. Like, oh, it's a whole thing. It's a whole thing. So I get to do that now, which has its own inherent lessons, but that is my current job. I always have a job in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I encourage you to do the same. So then once I have a job, my job is to fulfill the duties of that job. So that means learn everything I need to know about the job, and there's plenty of resources, pamphlets and websites and people who have gone before me who have done it, but it's my job to figure out how I do this job, right? And then to do it right and to show up and have a report if I need to have a report or be there on time or whatever it needs to be. And then when I'm done with the job, it's also my responsibility to rotate out and not try to hold on to that coffee pot just a little bit longer because it got really comfortable. Most of the jobs I've had in AA, I really learned and understood that job right about the time that I was going to rotate out of it. So that seems to be the ongoing joke and truth in Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of the time we're just flying by the seat of our pants going, I have no idea what I'm doing and I'm trying to figure it out. And somehow it works anyway, so why not, right? So the other thing that I can do, and I swear we're almost done, I can be a part of an informed group conscience. So that means that I attend our group business meetings and that I actually listen. And sometimes that's hard when I have no idea what people are talking about. I make an effort to understand the traditions, and I pay attention to what's going on in AA as a whole. And I don't really, like, enjoy hearing the treasurer's report, even when it is my own. But when I actually listen, I am taking responsibility, right? So I can also walk through my fears and stand for open service positions, which some of us are very uncomfortable doing, especially when it's going to require some kind of a vote or a thing or whatever, because being the self-centered and egocentric alcoholic that I am, I would like to think that it's a popularity contest of some kind. And it's not. I can stand, and standing for open service positions too means, like, you know what, I'm letting God decide. You know, I'm making myself available to be of service. That's actually how I got sucked into the area when I became area secretary. I was not like, yes, I really want to be area secretary. But I had people who were like, you should stand and be of service. And for some reason, the last time they'd had an election, only one person stood. And it wasn't cool just because you don't have, like, you know, options and things. And so somebody was like, you know what? It is service work just to stand. I heard somebody say that, service work just to stand. So I was doing service work just to stand. And I really was like, I'm cool if I don't get it. That's cool. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of work in this job. And I was elected. So there we are. But standing for service positions, I believe, is service in and of itself, right? Because it gives us options. And I can't let the fear of not getting the position keep me from doing it. So my responsibility in the grown-up middle is to make myself available and to be willing to do the work if given the job. A power greater than me ensures that I will end up where I am most useful. So I'm responsible, but I'm not in charge, right? Then I can also make sure that when I walk into a meeting, that I make myself available to be of service. Because I often, kind of like everybody else, I want to dash into the meeting maybe at, like, the last minute or whatever, or, like, I want to say hi to my buddies and, like, right after the meeting, like, hey, dude, how are you? Blah, 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 right? Like, that's my natural inclination. And chit-chat and, like, catch up with my friends. But the big book says our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So constant thought of others, that's a lot of responsibility. That means that I need to get there early. I need to scan the room. I need to see if there's a newcomer there who might need help, that might need a handshake. I need to not just go over to my friends and the people who are safe and comfortable for me. That after the meeting, if somebody picked up a white chip, if somebody looks new, if somebody looks scared like crap, you know, whatever, like, that's my responsibility to go to them and see if I can be of service after the meeting and not just run off with my friends. That's my responsibility, care to me, and sharing what I need to share. So being an attractive copy of the big book, being responsible for my recovery. You know, at the end of the day, I have to be responsible for my own recovery, because if I'm not recovered, then I'm not part of unity and I'm not part of this service. So anyway, that is basically my journey and responsibility, you know, my responsibility for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, while it sounds daunting and I've gone through a lot of things that you might be sitting there going like, oh, my God, that is so much stuff. And I know I have to think about that, like when I go to meetings and do all this other stuff and I have to get a job and da da da. One day at a time, you know, and ultimately, like, my responsibility is between me and God. Like, I have to keep things simple because I don't like responsibility. I got to keep things really, really simple. My responsibility is to continue to move forward one thing at a time, one day at a time, 1 hour at a time between me and God and do the next right thing. And if I do that, I will inherently do all of this that when I pile it up looks really daunting and very, very responsible. But somehow I got through all of this. And if I can learn to be responsible for stuff, I promise it is possible for literally anyone to do that. So thank you.